The items we're going to take up today are, first will be SB 128, Storage Tank Assistance Fund. We'll then go to SB 133, which is combining AGOC with PUC. We will not be hearing Senate Bill 151 on municipal property tax exemptions. I do not have all the information back that I thought was going to be here. Then we'll go to 157, which is power cost equalization. And then we'll go to SB 67, the governor's income tax plan. So with that, I'm going to ask my staff to come to the table and explain the CS that's before us on Senate Bill 128. Senator Phillips.
I just want to make it clear. On Senate Bill 151, we're not taking that up at this time. People here in the audience might want to go home.
They are. Go ahead, Darwin. Identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Darwin Peterson, staff of Senator John Torgerson. The Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 128, version K, the ECS we have in front of us. Lines 25 through 28 incorporated Senator Dahmer's amendments in the last meeting.
Too late.
And page 5, lines 9 through 12, we changed the criteria. This is in reference to the cleanup program. Now an applicant has to have a tangible net worth of $1 million or less on the effective date of this section of this bill section. We go to page 7, lines 17 through 19, the criteria there for a grant under the upgrade and closure program. An owner-operator has to have a tangible net worth of $250,000 or less. And then on
can we hold the noise down in the back here, please? Thank you. Continue.
And on section 12 of page 7, the CS defines tangible net worth for the purposes of the sections for the criteria.
How does it define it?
Sorry, Senator.
How does it define it? What page is that?
Page 7, 21.
Tangible net worth is defined on page 7, lines 21 through 28. It's basically an owner-operator's assets minus their liabilities.
I do have an amendment for that that I'd like the committee to consider. Senator Adams.
Well, we're on a subject, we're on net worth, and you do have your amendment that clarifies from that. Maybe your staff can go through that at some point.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, the amendment is intended to clean up the definition. On page 7, line 23, it will delete the words liabilities, including, so that it will read, tangible net worth means value of tangible assets, including existing assets and probable future economic benefits that will be obtained or controlled by the entity as a result of past transactions, minus liabilities associated with underground petroleum storage tanks. So the liabilities you can subtract from your assets to get your tangible net worth does not include liabilities, other liabilities, except for the liabilities that resulted from the underground storage tank contamination.
And the second part of the amendment is just deletion.
The second part of the amendment would insert a period after goodwill on line 28 and delete the rest of that so that, therefore, someone's royalties or rights to patents or income they receive from that type would be included in their net worth.
Other questions? Senator Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 7, line 22, when I read tangible net assets, including existing assets and probable future economic benefits, does that speak to future earnings? And I'm wondering if that then would require some sort of forecast, or do I read that differently? Is that an accounting term that perhaps I'm not aware of?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkin, this is a the definition that is accepted by general accounting procedures.
Does it then anticipate future earnings?
Yes, Senator.
Part of net worth?
Yes.
A second question, at the top of the page, line number two, the Federal Reserve discount rate, there's, I understand, a number of discount rates. How do we determine what that rate is? There's the federal funds rate, there's the interbank rate, there's two or three others. You might want to clarify where that discount rate is, where it's found. And it may be as simple as being posted in the Wall Street Journal.
I think it's San Francisco, but I really don't know. That was in the CS as it came to us, so I didn't follow that down.
We may just want to track that and narrow that down so one knows exactly which discount rate we're talking about. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Is there a motion to adopt? Oh, Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to really understand that section because it's a pretty dramatic change from the last CS proposal. Seems like somebody with $1 million net worth, that's a lot of money. I mean, a lot of people may have $1 million on paper, but they have an actual net worth of $1 million.
Is it a lot less than salaries?
That's a little high now that we've changed from gross to net. I would be thinking that something about half of that would be appropriate with it if we're using a net measure. Because the argument that was made against $1 million gross is somebody might be mortgaged up to 90% of that, you know, and getting by with a heavy debt load, and that made sense. But I don't think, conversely, it makes sense to say, you know, even though you've got $1 million worth of net assets, we're not going to make you pay anything for this loan. I mean, it's not a loan, it's a grant, right? No. I mean, I think that goes too far. It's a pretty radical swing the other way. So,
Mr. Chair.
I see what you're saying. Senator Green.
When we had testimony the other day, didn't we have someone speaking to the potential for someone who owned, just the equipment, the pumps, the whatevers? I mean, I don't know if we've kind of ratcheted that down to what's a reasonable value to place on that. And I think that's, I think you can have a lot of money in an operation. Then is suddenly not worth very much at all, but you could still have, on the one side, a lot of value.
Pardon me?
No, if we're backing out the liabilities, that changes it, but I think that you might, if we could hear something from someone who might know, it might help to kind of put it in a...
I think, Senator Donnelly, in my mind, if we take out the... My amendment number two, which says all liabilities are subtracted from that. The way that was sitting, you could write off your bank loans or future, if you had a lawsuit against you, or any liability could be deducted from this. What we're saying is you add up all your assets and you only get to write off the amount that was caused by the petroleum discharge or whatever the problem is. So that was my thought of the compromise, and, you know, trying to identify what the actual net worth was by this definition. If we leave minus liabilities in there as it currently is, you're right. That would be, who knows, $10 million corporation might have liabilities down to under what their net worth would be, under $1 million. And that wasn't my intent. But if you take the minus liabilities out of it, except for what's associated with the storage tank, then their debt and all these other things aren't included in that.
So your amendment number two, Mr. Chairman, addresses that.
Well, in my mind it does. I mean, but that's, I've looked at this so long, I'm getting brain dead on some of the changes that we've done. So I have to bring it back up for a reality check from the committee every now and then. Senator Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we go back to the beginning, there were members of this committee that looked at the list, and I would refer to enclosure number two that we had last time we brought this up. And the original intent was to get away from what amounted to corporate welfare and those large corporations that really didn't need a grant or a loan. We would want to eliminate them, knowing that full on that they could handle these expenditures themselves. And we wanted to protect what we came to know as the little guy, the mom and pop. If you go down to enclosure number two, which is 3.5 pages, I think you can just, without even knowing where Garrett's number one is or Woods Air Fuel, you can eliminate probably 80% of that list just by looking and seeing that they're going to have a net worth of greater than $1 million. So I think we can argue about the million or the 250, but if we stay at that number, which I would support, then we've essentially done what we started out to do, and that is protect small Alaskan companies while having the larger corporations that can handle the burden, handle it within their own structure.
Mr. Phillips, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah. Amendment number one was incorporated.
I think amendment number one was Senator Donnelly's amendment.
Yeah.
And that is incorporated.
I just want to clarify, so we don't have to deal with amendment number one anymore because it's in the bill.
Is there a motion to adopt the CS version K?
He moved it.
Oh, I didn't hear it.
He didn't hear you.
Chairman, I'd move we adopt May Substitute Senate Bill 129, Finance Version K, Lauterbach.
Is there objection? Hearing none, version K is before us. Maybe I'll committee's choice on amendment number two. Senator Donnelly.
I move amendment number two, Mr. Chairman.
The amendment number two has been moved. Is there a discussion? Is there objection to amendment number two? Hearing none, amendment number two has been adopted. Senator Adams.
Mr. Chairman, I just want the department to come up and we have a minute to see if actually that we're getting to where we want to go to continue to help the mom and pop companies. So if I can have them come up
sure. And
comment on the product here.
This could be the John and Steve show. You guys want to join us? Steve Doherty, Department of Law, and John Barnett with Executive Director of Storage Tank. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is John Barnett, Executive Director of the Board of Storage Tank Assistance. I'd like to commend you, Senator. This bill is a big improvement over the first one. In the discussions, there's a couple other items in here, but in the discussions related to the net worth, we believe the definition that was in here was actually suitable and would be appropriate, and the example we would use on that, I agree with Senator Donnelly, Mr. Chairman, that it sounds like the net worth of $1 million is a lot of money, but if you have one piece of property, and let's say that the contamination, let's say that it's a roadhouse again, we'll use that example with a small eight-room lodge and a gas station and a home on there, and they're sitting on 10, 20 acres of property on a highway. The actual asset value might be very high for that property. The contamination may be valued at $400,000, $200,000, but they still would not be able to borrow against that property because of the liability issue. So if it's a single owner, single property, if that owner owns other properties that could be leveraged, you know, or used as equity or collateral for financing cleanup, that would work. But if that's their only property and it has a book value minus the cleanup, estimated cleanup costs that still exceeds that $1 million, then they would not be able to obtain financing because of liability issue. Bank won't loan them any money. So. And they can't liquidate it because that's their only property. So we actually support the original language, which is the true definition of net worth as defined in federal law and also by the standardized practice, which is minus liabilities, which would be the notes, mortgages, and all that. And we do believe that, we understand your concerns, but you still may get some bigger companies in there, but we believe that most of those companies with multiple asset bases, larger companies, will probably have net worths closer to 5 to 10 to 15 million. We may have a few of these smaller companies that are actually lodge-type facilities that have a high net worth but still have no borrowing power. So that's one of the ones we want to address.
Hold that thought for a minute, please. And I'll go ahead. We'll stand at ease for a couple minutes.
State that for the record. What were we doing?
Mr.
Chairman, in response to a question by Senator Donnelly as to which definition of tangible net worth we prefer the definition outlined in the original CS prior to the adoption of Amendment Number 2, which is on in Section 12 of Page 7, lines 21 through 28. I think Steve Dorkey has some additional comments on that definition, but before I pass off to him, Mr. Chairman, I'd like permission to just speak to two issues I found in here. Number one is the effective date of July 1st for the cleanup loan program. That essentially means that the loans, basically the construction season will stop on, we won't be able to do any work effective July 1st until new regulations are implemented. And so we probably would miss this construction season, probably be looking at no cleanup funds being issued for loans or otherwise until loans and grants until next construction season, which will be spring of 2000. We also see that it would be helpful if there was transition language. If it's elected not to change the effective date on the cleanup program to 2000, then we would like to see transition regulation language allowing the department to start working on regulations as soon as this has been signed by the governor. The other point I saw in here that was noteworthy was on the section on loans, and which would be
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Donnelly.
On that last point, I don't understand. As soon as it's signed by the governor, it becomes law. Oh, you mean instead of waiting the usual 90 days to do it, you'd like us
Mr.
to write
Chairman.
Something that says start on regulations before the 90-day period goes or before the actual specific effective date goes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly, that's
okay.
Correct.
And they got the amendment right here. No sponsor yet.
Just to finish up my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Senator Phillips.
I see there's an amendment here dealing with transition regulations. This is what the Department of Law supports, right? I mean, I know you guys testified, but I wrote the Department of Law. This is what you proposed about maybe 4 or 5 days ago. So this is a, we have to reword it, but
we have it from Andy.
I have it. They're the ones that passed it out.
Mr. Chairman,
this is transition for regulation.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Stephen Doherty from the Department of Law. We did submit some earlier proposed language, and it would have to be changed in order to fit the new CS, but that language would just serve the purpose.
Okay.
Continuing on, Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other point besides the effective dates and the net worth that we saw was in the tank cleanup loan program on page 5, which would be section 10, lines 18 down through 24, specifically line 24 on the loan program. And I believe this language is actually in the resource CS as well, Mr. Chairman, so I apologize if I didn't catch this before, but it notes here that basically the owner or operator agrees to accept a loan in the same or lesser amount instead of a grant for the same project. That would essentially set a cap on loans of $250,000, and I believe that that may cause a problem. We may see a situation where we have a cleanup which exceeds $300,000-$400,000. We have several of those ongoing in Fairbanks right now. And under this bill, we would be able to provide that small businessman with a $250,000 grant. But under this language, he would then also not be able to get a loan beyond that grant, is the way I interpret it. So if he has a $400,000 cleanup, he's received a $250,000 grant, he's reached an overall cap, and then he's stuck. We've spent $250,000 of state money on the site, and then he can't get additional financing. So I don't have any specific language in mind, but I might suggest that that be looked at just to raise the amount available on a loan to cover the additional costs above and beyond the $250,000 grant limit.
Would you have a suggested cap on the amount of the loan?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know that our program over the last few years, we've hit some of the most contaminated sites, and we're ongoing on a lot of those, so probably $500,000 at a minimum.
I didn't pick up on that language either as a cap.
Right, and I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I should have looked at that earlier. Mr. Chairman, those are the only comments I have at this time. Basically, net worth, effective dates, and related to the caps on the loans. But maybe Mr. Doherty here could address some of those net worth questions.
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Law would prefer the definition in the work draft CS without the amendment as well. The definition presented in the work draft is a standard definition based on the federal definition that's used in the CFRs. It's also consistent with what I think a business expects net worth to be. And with what they would generally report as net worth to other agencies, banks, lenders, that type of thing. So there would be some background that we could check the network against if we were to be concerned that someone had filed a misleading statement about their net worth. We would be able to confirm it by other documents where they have reported their net worth. If the amendment changes are made, we would no longer have a consistent definition that could be checked with other definitions of net worth. And the first amendment, excluding liabilities, we wouldn't count the note for purchase of a facility. It could be a $2 million note for the purchase of the facility, so they could end up with a negative net worth still in real terms. But under this bill, they would have a positive net worth because that purchase price of the facility and the note on the facility would not be included in the calculation of net worth if the amendment were in place. The other issue...
The amendment is in place.
Yes.
It's incorporated in there, so...
Yes, if you keep that amendment in place, that's the effect. It would be different.
That's my intent, just for the reasons you just said.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure that all the committee members are aware of what that does. Also, if you look at the exclusion of goodwill and the value of patents or royalties, goodwill and patents and royalties are very difficult to determine what their value is. And that's why they are normally excluded in the definitions as used by the federal government. It's a very intense, very factual, fact-specific, and very subject to debate and litigation as to what those values are. So it is much easier to enforce a definition that just excludes those nebulous concepts rather than trying to require that they be valued in each case. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Barnett?
Mr. Chairman, in response to, I think, an earlier question by Senator Donnelly regarding the probable future economic benefits, the way we understand that is that that's accounts receivable. So So that'd be accounts your account, basically revenues you expect to receive for goods or services sold. So the way I understood that, probable economic benefits would just be those accounts receivable on the books. Just answer that question, sir.
Do you think we need to clean that up a little bit for Senator Wilkins' concern? Senator Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, if that's the generally accepted definition, that's fine, as long as other people look at that. I would just want to make sure it wasn't future earnings. So if that's, if it's just receivables, that's fine. Thank you.
Senator Green.
Mr. Chairman, from the point where this bill started to where we are now, the title includes the termination date of the Board of Storage Tank Assistant as being fairly soon. Since this is being reworked somewhat and there will be an advocacy role for someone, is it still appropriate to terminate the Board of Storage Tank Assistant?
I would believe so.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to check because I know we've come a long way in the way the bill's written. And
remember, they have 1 year after it terminates to still be there. So the actual drop dead date is July of, or June 30 of 2000. So they have a year to work through where we're at. The deadline's passed for submission for any new, I mean, everybody's supposed to be on the rosters by now, the 1,700 or whatever it is. So I haven't heard a compelling reason to keep the board around after the June 30, 2000 deadline. Other questions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman? How did you want to proceed? Did you want to proceed with conceptual amendments, or did you want to go back and because
I'd like to get as much of this done as we can. I'm probably not going to be able to pass it out today because we haven't worked out the fiscal note yet.
Okay.
Senator Parnell, that's what he's doing right now, is trying to make the fiscal note based upon the actions that we did with the budget and so forth. So we're a little bit beyond that fiscal note, and I want the committee to look at that before I pass it out. But I would like to offer as many, if we can, even if we have to take a short break to get them written out, I'd like to do that so we get done with the bill.
Well,
Senator Phillips and then Senator Donovan.
The reason I brought that up was because I would move as a conceptual amendment that the effective date for the regulation rate rewriting.
Yeah, I think we have a suggested amendment there. I don't have it in my packet either, so we may have to.
Of course, it isn't designed for this version of the bill. It would have to be conceptual to do what it's like.
Yeah, maybe make it get that ran off. Do all members have that? Am I the only one? I may have it in this pile.
Couldn't find it.
I may have watered
it up. Mr. Chairman, they were passing it around here about 4 or 5 days ago.
All right, we'll get one stamped in. I think Senator Phillips, are you going to sponsor the amendment?
Yeah.
Okay, Senator Phillips will sponsor the amendment. Senator Wilkins? Senator Finance will stand at ease. Senator Finance, please come back to order. Senator Phillips.
Department of Law. You have the amendment in front of you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Phillips, yes, I do have this.
Okay, you recognize it as yours, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would move conceptually, because this is amendment was written to two versions back. We'll let our legal department figure out which page in line with the current version, which is K, marked Lauderback 42899. I'll move the transition language of regulations as suggested by Department of Law.
The amendment number 3 has been moved. I'll object for discussion purposes. My first question is on line 8, the June 2099. That's the date on June 2099. Seems like an odd date. Okay, I don't have. Discussion on the amendment.
Maybe
Mr. Daugherty?
Mr. Chairman, that is a typo. That should be June 30, 1999.
Okay.
That's why I asked if you recognize it.
And just tell us what this actually does here.
Mr. Chairman, basically what this amendment would do is at first it would, if you look at the first paragraph A, it allows the department to get started on a regulations project to implement the changes made by this act prior to those changes becoming effective. The regulations themselves would not become effective until after the changes brought by the act, the other changes made by the act become effective. But it would allow the regulations project to get started prior to that time. So as soon as this bill was signed by the governor, the department could start the process of putting a regs package together and putting it out to public notice. That would speed up the process of getting the regs into place by 2 or 3 months.
Senator Phillips.
Make the record clear. I'll just make the correction for deleting June 20th and inserting June 30th as the amendment.
Okay. What we have is an amendment to the amendment number 3 to delete on on line 8 to delete 20 and insert 30. So it'll read June 30, 1999. Senator Adams.
And I think that under new CS section number 14, you have to change that to whatever. Section 14 on this one is the repealer section.
Right. I think Senator Phillips moves it as conceptual to let the drafters add it in wherever it could be.
What's appropriate.
Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, that will be adopted. Was you through with your... Oh, Senator Donnelly.
I added in another conceptual amendment to that.
Okay. We'll get that printed off.
Short, Donnelly?
Yeah, it's short.
Let's finish with this one. I want to adopt this one first. Mr. Doherty, you through with your explanation?
Mr. Chairman, that's it for Part A. Part B basically serves to keep the existing regulations of the department in place to the extent that they're not inconsistent with the changes made by this act. Basically, that just keeps the department from having to go back and readopt all its existing regulations in conformance with the changes made by this act, and would make those provisions that are of existing regulation that are inconsistent with this act would automatically be repealed by implication. But the department would probably fix those in a regs project as well under A, but it keeps them from having to go back and readdress all their regulations in the regs project, Mr. Chairman.
You're confusing us, okay? It's your amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
You know, if you want it, you can have it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Phillips, the existing regulations, there is an argument that some of those regulations would be repealed by implication by changing the statutory authorities because they rely on the existing statutes. When this becomes law, there will be an argument. It's not a clear argument, but there is an argument that some of those regs are repealed by implication. Basically, this amendment would protect the regulations to the extent that they are not inconsistent with the new act.
Senator Green.
Would we be avoiding part of this conversation if we just had an effective date that was delayed somewhat to allow the normal regulatory process to proceed?
I think that's what he's trying to do when he says not inconsistent with the act. Anything that we're changing, they wouldn't be able to override it with regs, is what I read that as. Senator Donnelly.
Yeah. I mean, unless there was something specific in the existing regulations we didn't like, I suppose it was okay.
Well, that's... You're rolling the dice on that one, I know.
Yeah, exactly.
Trust me, Department of Law. I have a question on line 3. Why do we have the Department of Environmental Conservation or the Board of Storage Tank?
Mr. Chairman, under the existing law, there are some authorities that are given to the department to adopt regulations. After consulting with the board, there are other regulations that are directly adopted by the board. And that would still be the case after passage of these
of this act. There are would still be authorities that are given to the department and authorities that are given to the board.
Okay, I'm not sure I like that. Senator Donnelly.
So you're saying during this last year, their sunset year, the board would still be adopting regulations?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Donnelly.
I'd actually like to limit the authority to adopt regulations to the department rather than a board that's going out of business.
Senator Adams.
You can't hear what you stated.
I said it might be more prudent to limit the authority to adopt regulations to the department, since they're going to have to live with it, and the board's going out of business in a year, they're not going to be around, and the department will still be there and have to deal with it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly, there's no conceptual problem from the Department of Law. There's not a problem with it giving the authority to the board, I mean to the department rather than the board, but I haven't had a chance to review the new CS thoroughly, but I believe that the CS actually gives some regulatory authority to the board, and that those provisions would also need to be changed if you're going to limit the regs authority to the department.
Senator Donnelly.
Well, yeah, they're going to be changed because the board isn't going to be there anymore in a year, right? So, and I'm not addressing it from a legal problem. It's a policy problem, a public policy call. Whether you want the board in its final year to adopt a bunch of regulations, and then it's not going to be around, or whether you rather have the department that's going to have to administer those regulations being responsible for adopting them. You better have the department, because they're going to be around and have to live with them. So if we just... This will just make it... We'd make it a little bit harder for the board to go off on that route.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly, my problem is that under the current draft, the department doesn't have enough authority to adopt regs. Most of that regs authority is on the board in current law and with the CS, and we would need some additional changes to the CS in order to switch that authority over to the department.
I'd go probably the reverse of what you are. I'd take the department out of there and leave it all with the board, and then it'll have to come back and forth for the department to have authority to go any farther. Mr. Donnelly.
Was that your intent, Mr. Chairman, because under the CS, the board's going to sunset, right? So they would be adopting regulations over the next year that complied with this, and then they'd sunset? Is that the way you wanted to do it?
It makes it come back and forth, I think, to some degree. But I would take the department out of there and leave the board in there. That's just let it go away.
And so I think I understand your thinking, and I think it's a good argument. I mean, it's a good thought that they'd be more responsive to be make sure the regulations are consistent with the legislative intent and the statute. If they knew this agency was going to have to come back before us within a year, they were going to get
this one. We're shifting it when the board or either one of them can adopt regs, and I don't. The bill doesn't talk about the environmental conservation or the department adopting regs and doing things, and that just makes me nervous. So it's just, you know, I would.
Hopefully Senate Bill 24 will pass, and I'll have some money.
Yeah. Okay, quickly, Mr. Barnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Just real quickly as to the relationship with the board and the department. The original legislative intent when the program was first enabled was that the industry out there, the tank owners and operators, did not want full authority to draft possible hostile regulations on them that might be too onerous for them to comply with. Their intent was to have a board made up of the insurance industry, tank owners and operators, contractors and consultants to actually develop the financial assistance portions of the regulations, and then for that board to act as an appeal board
to resolve disputes, and it gave the board and their representatives from industry oversight over the department. So the board's authority was over the department. And in concurrence with Mr. Doherty, if you eliminated the board, you would have to basically go into other statutes that are not included in this CS, which resolve disputes. The board mediates disputes between tank owners over cleanup plans.
I understand that. My intent is to take the department out, not the board.
Right.
So that you continue on for another year and a half and get your business done, and then sunset and go away.
Leave me alone.
Other discussion? Senator Green.
Is that actually going to happen? Are all these transactions going to be completed?
I don't know if all the transactions will go away, but
because I know I've heard great concern expressed by some of my constituents over more over the loss of the board. Is that, you know, has proven where they've gotten their good advice and information and had more of a working relationship with them. Now I don't know if that's good or bad, but.
Okay, amendment number 3 is offered. Is there, Senator Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, would you entertain an amendment to the amendment to take out DEC?
I would, sir.
Okay. I'll, where the words DEC appear, delete it.
Okay. I'll move. This will be the second amendment.
And there's, it appears.
Amendment number 3.
It appears twice in the proposed amendment.
And that is to delete out anywhere that refers to the Department of Environmental Conservation. Shows on lines 3 and 4 and on line 11. Is there objection to the amendment?
Just an understanding, Mr. Chairman, that basically the Board of Storage Tank Assistance will be the one that may adopt all the regulations at this point.
Okay? Correct.
Finally, law. I forgot
about it. Senator Wilkins, I see you down there.
I wonder, Mr. Chairman, if we might hear from, if there's someone here from the department that might tell us what the problems we're creating, if any.
He's been waving his hand like a flag, so I'm sure he is. Mr. Doherty.
Mr. Chairman, under the current statute and also with your CS, I believe, there are still authorities that would be necessary to be exercise that the board does not have and that this bill does not grant. So if you eliminate the department, I don't think they're going to be able to adopt regulations to fully implement the changes made by this act and to have a workable program. The way the responsibilities are split up, the board has primary authority in the financial arena, and the department has primary authority over the actual cleanup standards and that type of thing, but there are interaction between the two, and I believe that there would be changes necessary in the department's regulations as well as the board's regulations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Hayden may have more on that issue.
Do you have a question for Mr. Hayden, Senator Wilkins?
I'd just like to know his comment on the effect of removing, the effect of accepting the amendment to amendment number 3, and that is removing DEC from the regulation process.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jim Hayden. I'm manager of the storage tank program for DEC. Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkin, the way we're set up now, in the total package of existing statute, the way we operate now is that the Board of Storage Tank Assistance oversees the financial aspects of the grant program, and they adopt the regulations that deal with that portion of the program. And the department basically adopts regulations that cover everything else, including the prevention rules for underground storage tanks and the cleanup rules for underground storage tanks. So if the language is changed under this amendment before us, before the committee, then in my opinion, it would make it unworkable. and inconsistent with the...
Mr. Hayden, this is just transition language. You can still adopt regulations 90 days after the bill is signed. Isn't that correct? There'd be a 90-day window in there. You wouldn't be able to do anything or whatever it takes from the time the bill is signed to the time you are authorized to do your regulations or send your notices out. So this is not a dead pill for DEC. It's just you, the only people that can adopt regs to bring this into compliance, it would be the Borage Tank Assistance Program, which has direct responsibility for this program. So if the department needs to make corresponding changes to their regs, they can do it through the normal process. This doesn't exclude you from doing that.
Mr. Chairman, I still believe that the two will be inconsistent. The existing statute that will not be affected by this bill will be inconsistent as currently written, and I would have to ask the Department of Law to comment further on that. Thank you.
Do we have an amendment? Is there other questions or witnesses? We have an amendment to the amendment number 3. More discussion on that. Is there objection to adopting the amendment?
Yes.
A roll call, please.
Senator Lehman? Senator Wilkin?
No.
Senator Adams?
No.
Senator Kelly?
No.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Parnell? Senator Torgerson?
Yes.
So by 4-3, amendment number three has been adopted. That brings back before us amendment number 3. Further discussion. Is there objection to amendment number 3?
Yes.
Roll call, please.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Lehman? Senator Wilkin?
Yes.
Senator Adams?
No.
Senator Kelly?
Yes.
Senator
Green?
Yes.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Parnell?
Senator
Torgerson?
Yes.
6-1 vote, amendment number 3 is passed. Senator Donnelly.
Just a point of procedure. I move that Senator Lehman, for the period of his illness, because he had an accident, be shown as excused. Votes in the Finance Committee.
Senator Donnelly, we've never shown anybody excused on our records.
Well, I think it's a good reason in this case. I mean, he's got 4 broken ribs. And
well, I understand that, but even if somebody's excused on the floor, we don't make excuse absences from committees.
I'd like the record to reflect then that the reason he's not here is because, you know, he's got 4 broken ribs.
Well noted.
At least not a hockey player.
Did you note that for the record? Okay. That brings us to amendment number 4. Senator Donald.
Mr. Chairman, I move conceptual amendment number 4.
We have before us conceptual amendment number 4. The amendment, Senator Donald, you just explain the amendment.
This was the issue that was brought up by the department or the discussion earlier. It would simply, when we do the next CS, would clarify that there's a maximum, it would add a maximum cap on loans of $500,000 and maintain the maximum cap on grants at $250,000, but say that if somebody was eligible for a grant, they could still be eligible for a loan up to a maximum amount, combination of the two, $500,000.
Discussion on amendment number 4. Senator Wilkins, then Senator Green.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm concerned about, and I'm not sure how the system works, but I'm concerned about somebody reaching their max and then not having the ability to get additional money to clean up their site. Does then the federal government come in and do something to shut them down, or did something happen because we put what amounts to this artificial lid on how the state can help, and our goal here is to keep people in business and get and keep people clean. So it's a comment I would ask from the department or from the administration.
Chairman, Senator Wilkin, for purposes of discussion here, we'll take the cleanup program, and if someone has a serious spill and has a multi-year cleanup, then the cost of that could easily reach $1 million for the most serious site. And if that person is limited to a cap of less than that, then they're still responsible to clean up the site. And what would happen if they became financially unable to respond is that the state would have the option to step in under basically the response program we have within our division to handle sites that are a threat. And also the EPA could also step in as well. So you are correct that the EPA could step in on that. And
we're not trying to help anyone.
We have had that happen before in the late 80s when a site was very serious and escalated and became a neighborhood problem. And the state stepped in to the extent it could, and EPA also stepped in, so it was a joint response. And that's likely what would happen under this scenario for the more serious site.
Senator Green and Senator Kelly.
He somewhat answered my question, Mr. Chairman, but I was wondering, would that cap include any participation prior to the effective date of this bill on those multi-year cleanups? Would, if they've already received $250,000 in the past, would they then be limited to another $250,000? And then I guess we need to know how many cleanups have exceeded $500,000.
Oh, no. You stumped the panel, Senator Green. Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment that I think a lot of these people didn't ask for this, and some of them aren't even responsible for the sites that they have, for the spill that's on the sites that they have. And if we put this limit on them, we're going to defeat the whole purpose of this, and that is to protect them from what I feel are unworkable federal regulations. Either we have the program and it's in such a way that it's successful, or we don't have the program at all, because I think we're going to be leaving a whole bunch of sites out there that never ever get cleaned up. People just go bankrupt and let their property go, and then we're just going to have a piece of property that the state owns and the state's responsible for cleaning up, or somebody is, I don't know who. So I don't support this amendment.
Keep in mind that the $500,000 was from their testimony, that that's what they thought would be a great cap for a cap on the what we should do.
I know a lot of these
that wasn't invented.
$500,000.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Donna.
Well, one thing maybe we can agree on is that there ought to be a higher limit than $250,000. If somebody gets a grant, if that's not enough to do it, they should still be able to access loans. Because that's a problem that I agree. You know, so this would raise that maximum limit to $500,000, where under the existing CS it's $250,000. So if this is
whole... Discussion maintained to amendment number four.
Yep.
Okay, roll call, please.
Senator Wilkin?
No.
Mr. Well, Chairman, if we have a timeout, just heard our timeout just a moment. Senator Donnelly was about to make a comment, I think, on...
I'm just saying, if we didn't pass this, we should come back and at least pass that bottom part or... Address that issue somehow. So that's okay. We can just vote this one way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Other discussion on amendment number four? Okay. Roll call, please.
Senator Green?
No.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
So by a 4-3 vote, amendment number 4 has been adopted. Is there any other amendments on the secretary's desk? Anything else? Any discussion on the bill? If the committee wants to look at the fiscal note, I'll hold the bill, but if you want to assume that we're going to have the correct fiscal note, I'll entertain a motion to move the bill out of committee. Senator Phillips.
Chairman, I'll move the pay version 428.99, Lauderback, CS for SB 128 Finance, as amended.
Motion to move the K version with individual recommendations with a fiscal note.
Get rid of it.
Is there objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 128 is moved out of committee.
When they rewrite it, it should be structured in a way it'd be easy to raise the total cap to like $1 million or something.
Next, we're going to go to Senate Bill 133.
So it'd be easy to amend it.
We'll stand at ease of place till the sponsor comes in. I have drafted a committee substitute version K. The sponsor staff can walk us through those amendments, but I believe we've incorporated most all the parts of the amendments 1-9 in here, except for one small exception. So we'll have them. No, 8's included in its entirety.
Okay, there's a problem.
Senator Pierce.
Got a problem.
New commission to name?
Pardon me?
We're ready.
That's who wants it.
Also,
Megalopolis Monopoly.
Chairman, your staff has worked with Mr. Carter, and we have before you a work draft version K by Mr. Kramer for Senate Bill 133. And you would like me to go through the changes quickly?
I think we should. Yeah.
I don't think there's anything new from what we talked about yesterday. page 1, Arika seems concerned about the title, said it was too early, so it is now the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And we also, in the title change, deleted the refuse language because the refuse section is no longer in the bill, so that present law would stand when it comes to refuge. On page 2, lines 22-24, removal of commissioner. We adopted the additional language at the request of the administration from House Bill 183, which allows the removal of a commissioner if he or she is convicted of a misdemeanor relating to public utilities or is convicted of a felony. The additional language continues to be the language that is presently the AOGCC language. On page 3, lines 23-26, under contractual arrangements, as we said yesterday, this would allow the chairman to enter into a limited contractual arrangement for consultants or expertise that may be required. Contracts exceeding $5,000 would require the support of a majority of the full commission. On page 4, line 28, and page 5, lines 20-25, on the public advocacy section, this amendment would establish within the PUC a separate public advocacy section. The section would represent the public interest in adjudicatory functions before the commission, and the chairman of the commission would decide when the public interest needs to be represented by the advocacy section, as opposed to the way it's being done at present, where the executive director does that. In the past, as we talked yesterday, commission staff has served a dual role, trying to serve both as an advisor and an advocate. That dual function has been problematic on the flow of communication, and this suggestion actually came from the NARI report, National Regulatory Research Institute report, to the Public Utilities Commission that they had done last fall, And this advocacy section is how the FCC and FERC both function. On page 5, lines 10 through 13, we added an amendment that requires the Commission to adopt the regulations that establish standards regarding time frames in which the Commission shall address differing types of cases. And there is a drafting error, Mr. Chairman, on page 5, line 10. The date should be December 31st, 1999, not 2000, and that's an error that Ms. Kramer made. It was always our intent to have it 1999. So you would please note that, sir. We didn't change page 6. On page 7, lines 19 through 21, on the appeals process, the amendment puts in statute the outline that I talked about yesterday, where the Commission only considers an appeal if the Commission made a decision that was contrary to a precedent ruling and was not based on an intervening change in the actual law by either ourselves or by the Fed. The decision on whether to grant the appeal is at the discretion of the Commission, and if the appeal is denied, the previous ruling of the Commission is final. There is, of course, always an appeal process to the courts available. Page 7, lines 30 through 31. The arbitrator language was added. It permits the Commission to allow formal hearings to be held by an arbitrator for a designated purpose by the Commission. It gives them one more tool that they can utilize, we hope, to be more efficient and more effective. On page 8, lines 10 through 13, we have embodied the suggestion by both our auditors and the NERI report of a time management system. This clarifies the intent of the regulatory cost charge to be based on the workload of the Commission as it relates to individual industry sectors, so that the cost causer becomes the cost payer. And Mr. Chairman, I was a member of this committee back in the early 90s when we put the original regulatory cost charge into law, and former Senator Porchot was the one who I believe was the prime sponsor of that bill. It had always been the intent of the legislature to have a time management system that was based on workload of the individual industry sectors, so that the electric utilities don't pay for telephone wars, and the telephone utilities and consumers don't have to pay for electric wars, and so on and so forth. That it hasn't happened that way with this time management system that we are requiring in law that has been in audit all the way since 1977, as I remember, the commission we hope will finally get what we want to speak. Page 9, lines 27 and 28. This is the insertion of the refuse language, Senator Green's amendment. Page 10, lines 5 through 7, and page 11, there are only name changes to the new name of the commission so it won't sound so oily. And on page 12, lines 2 through 5, that's again management information system that requires that the commission develop an MIS system and that the system be accessible to the general public through the internet. It would be similar to our basic system. And maybe they could do PLN. Wouldn't that be fun? And lines 24 through 28, we changed the terms, the initial terms of the commissioners, so that they rotate on a yearly basis, so that the commission never has more than one new commissioner at a time, so that we build continuity of the commissioners. Sorry. And on pages 13, 14, and 15, there are name changes only. There was a point made by Jenny Fay yesterday from the Department of Commerce that I want to clarify, because she and I were both incorrect, if I can find it. On page 3, lines 11 through 15, section 4204040, legal counsel, the language in subsection A is the language from the AOGCC statutes, Mr. Chairman. The Department of Law has asked us that for the PUC that we would delete on lines 12 and 13, the language, the legal counsel provided by the Department of Law is subject to the approval of the Commission. And I don't have a major dispute with that request. I can certainly understand the Department of Law not wanting to have to go through an approval process as they assign their attorneys to entities of the state. Subsection B, 14 and 15, the commission may contract for the services of specialized legal counsel or legal consultants. The Department of Law does not like that language. They would rather that only the Department of Law can do that sort of contracting. At this point in time, we're still discussing that, and what I would like the committee to entertain is not making that change at this time. I'll continue working with the Department of Law to better understand their points and for them to better understand our points. The NERI report would lead us to believe that perhaps the commission should be able to contract for legal counsel above and beyond the Department of Law, and we'll continue talking with them about how we might make that happen. But 1, 12, and 13, I would not have a problem with that deletion. And I think that's all for.
Any questions?
There is a system note.
Oh,
sure. As we expected, there are two, as a matter of fact, one from the Department of Administration because of the relocation. And I might add that the Department of Administration has told us they hope to have the AOGCC move finalized early this fall, perhaps as early as September, to get them over to the new building since the old building is so inadequate. So hopefully we'll see a functioning merged staff that can begin working with each other and sharing expertise as early as September. We also have a fiscal note from the PUC. Do you have that yet?
No.
Maybe.
We don't have it.
I don't have it. I have the finance. I mean, Department of Administration.
Question? Okay, go ahead.
As I told you yesterday, we thought that we had to have a fiscal note because if the PUC sunsets under our operating budget bill, that money goes away, and there wasn't any way, we were concerned there wasn't a way to get to the funding, so this would fund the new entity. I believe the dollars are the same as what's in the operating budget. There's not a change.
Fiscal note marked draft. Questions of the sponsor? Is there a motion to adopt the K version?
I would so move, Mr. Chairman.
There's a motion to adopt LS-0771 version K, dated 4/29/99. There was objection.
Yeah, just have time on one talk to Senator Donnick.
Senator Finance will stand at ease.
Yeah, I was going to move that we adopt version K, excluding the language on page 3, line 25 and 26. And Donnelly, were you?
Line 14 and 15, same page.
I'll object.
Yeah, this just seems like wide open language, Mr. Chairman, to run off the cost of some of these proceedings. Can I answer a couple of questions, too? Senator Pierce, do you know does the commission have available the essentially the Department of Law or the AG's office in these proceedings?
They have at least two Department of Law attorneys assigned to the commission. The language on page 3 and lines 23 through 26, the commission presently has the authority to bring in outside, under contract, outside contractual folks to help them with specific cases and specific expertise, and they've always had that. The change here is giving the commission that authority rather than the executive director, which is where that authority is now. Commissioner Kelly. So B is, the change in B is not that we're giving them the authority to do something new, it's that we're giving the commission the authority to do it as opposed to the executive director as is presently the case. They do bring in outside experts to help them with specific cases on an ongoing basis. If you look at their budgets, you'll see that there are always some fairly hefty contractual expenditures over the years. And for example, in this year's budget that has already been approved, the commission has $1.3 million in contractual debt for those sort of outside folks that they do hire on cases. So I would actually say, Senator Kelly, that deleting that subsection under employment of commission personnel probably would force the commission to try to go through some other agency to contract for that sort of outside expertise, and you're just adding a layer of bureaucracy. Now, going back up to the legal counsel section 4204040, and was your amendment to take out the legal counsel provided by the department subject to the approval of the commission that I had said, or were you going to the next line?
No, actually, my concerns are more with what we were just talking about. The commission may contract for and engage in the services of a consultant and experts as the commission considers necessary. It just seems like the language is too wide open there.
It is. Well, it's only wide, you know, you can have the commission explain to you what they do with their contractual services. They have always had the ability to hire outside expertise for cases, and as I say, this doesn't change that. They do not have on staff experts in every facet, nor can we expect them to without a fairly high cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
So, Senator Kelly, you still have an amendment to the main motion.
I will.
Well, I was just going to ask if there's anybody. I'd like, first of all, this is incredibly complex stuff. This is telecommunication stuff, right? And this is coming pretty fast and furious. I'd like on this specific question to see if any member of the public would like to testify before I make a decision on this specific thing, because this does seem really wide open to me, but I'd like to hear what the public, you know, if there's anybody in the public is here that wants to
$5,000 contract, are we talking about that?
No, I'm talking about on lines 14 and 15, which is the amendment that's before us, the commission may contract for services of specialized legal consultant, you know, that could be unlimited. That could be millions of dollars in the telecommunications area. And I'm just concerned about that, and I was wondering if, you know, if that concern was, if there was something that somebody could come up and testify to allay that concern or reinform.
Let's just amend it out. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Law is here and can speak to that section. As I pointed out, that is a section that the lines 14 and 15 are a section that the Department of Law is concerned about, and I have already said that I was working with them on what language made sense. This is an implication coming out of the audit that the APUC had done, that it would be useful for them to be able to have the specialized legal counsel, but we're already discussing that particular point, but they're here. They can testify to the Department of Law.
Okay. Let's have the Department of Law come up. There's no one here from the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, there's somebody in Anchorage from the Department of Law.
All right. Introduce yourself, and did you hear the question?
I think, Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert E. Bennett. I'm the Attorney General. And I believe the question has to be proposed section 4204040.
Sir, can you get a little closer to the microphone?
Better.
That's much better.
It's the Department of Law's position that if the commission has the authority to contract for outside counsel, that it would be preferable, and I believe more in accordance with standard practice, for that contracting to be subject to the approval of the Department of Law. Alternatively, if this subsection were not in the bill at all, I'm fairly confident that the department could, if necessary, make its own arrangements for outside counsel when specialized expertise is required. So I think those are two possible alternatives.
Senator Kelly?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Remove the amendment?
I have an objection.
Okay.
I'm removing
okay.
my objection.
All
right.
Senator Donnelly?
So we're left with the main motion to adopt.
Main motion is back to floor.
Mr. Chairman, I think it'd be good to adopt the TS without at least page 3, lines 14 and 15, and then allow people to work out something and add it back in rather than have that in there to start with. So I just move to amend the CS as proposed to be adopted, just to delete lines 14 and 15 on page 3.
Okay, there is an amendment to the main motion, which is to delete lines 14 and 15. I'll object. Or Senator Green object. Senator Pierce. Other discussion on the amendment to the main motion? Roll call, please.
Senator Kelly?
No.
Senator Green?
No.
Yes.
Judge
Bobby? Yes.
Judge Lehman?
Judge
Wilkin? Judge
Adams? No. Judge Brown? Judge Ferguson? No. 2-8, 4-8. So by a 2-4 vote, the amendment to the main motion has not been adopted. That brings back the main motion, which is to adopt LS 0771K Kramer 42999. Is the objection still maintained? Hearing none, we have adopted that work draft. We have a couple conceptual amendments that the sponsor mentioned that I'd like to deal with before we go back to any public testimony. The first one is on page 5, line 10, to delete 2000 and insert 1999. So if somebody would move that, please.
I would so move.
There's a motion to delete, again for the Secretary, page 5, line 10, delete 2000 and insert 1999. Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 11. Amendment number 11 is passed. Okay, amendment number 12, if offered, would be on page 3, lines 12 and 13, to delete the sentence, the legal counsel provided by the Department of Law is subject to approval of the Commission. Somebody move that, if you wish.
What page, what line?
Page 3, lines 12. The sentence that starts with the down through line 13, which ends with commission.
Okay.
That's at the Department of Law's request.
And so moved, Mr. Chairman.
Motion to delete that. Does the Secretary have the motion or have the amendment? Okay. This will be amendment number 12. Is there objection to amendment number 12? Hearing none, that is adopted. So that brings us back a relatively clean working draft. Senator Pierce, do you have any comments on it?
No, sir.
Other discussion on the bill before we go to whatever we're going to go to? I don't normally open these back up for public testimony, but I guess we have some requests. Senator Donnelly.
Just under general discussion, I got to tell you, I'm really concerned about the openness of the language on page 4, sections 10 through 13, regarding the having the commission adopt regulations to establish standards of timeliness. APUC has been notorious for the entire time I've been here about being untimely in their decisions, and it's kind of like the fox guarding the hen house example of having them established regulations on what's timely or not. In the past, we've had to actually put statutory limits on the time they take on things, and that's been the only thing that's been successful in motivating them to produce decisions in time. So although the amendment that we just did is certainly a positive step, I'm still remain very concerned that the scheme adopted in here is not to set something in statute, because I just don't think they'll do the job in a timely manner. And if they can do the regulations, they're going to do them in a way that ensures they don't have to do the job in a timely manner, is my guess.
I didn't get what page that was on, Senator Darling.
Page 5, lines 10 through 13.
Oh, okay.
I think under existing law, Mr. Chairman, about 10 years ago when I was chairing Labor and Commerce or more, we actually had to put in some statutory time limits to get the commission to make some decisions that it put off for years. And I hope we're not losing those statutory timelines with this CS. We may want to consider doing some statutory timelines, too.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Adams.
One of the problems that we have with timely decisions being made is because we don't put the expertise of professionals on that particular committee. And that's one of the things we need to look at, is if you look at, you need to put the professional background in electric utilities, so you need to put a professional in telecommunications, or you need to put a professional in water sewer. And that's one of our problems, is we don't put the technical expertise that is needed. We just put in the language that five commissioners may be appointed by the governor. And that's our problem here, is sometimes these appointees are, no matter if you're Republican or Democrats, they are political appointees that somebody needs a job without their expertise. And that's where our problem goes. And if you don't have the expertise in that particular field, then you delay the decisions being made on those certain cases. That's our problem.
Other discussion?
I would just say that's something I don't like about the bill myself, because we haven't delineated the background of some of these members.
Okay.
And I guess Senator Pierce, mm-hmm.
Chairman. Senator Kelly.
What's the rationale, and I know you covered this before, what is the rationale of just having the membership in this being open as far as expertise?
Well, the rationale is we couldn't figure out a way to define what we wanted without ending up in a situation like we ended up with 3 years ago with the ALGCC commissioner, if you'll allow me to speak to a specific situation that wasn't a CUC. We have asked, frankly, all the different utilities of all sorts to give us suggestions as to what they would like to see for specific, for specific qualifications for somebody to be a member of the PUC. We have gotten everything from the language that came from ARECA that you saw yesterday that just says one person shall have telecommunications experience and another shall have electric experience, to a fairly specific definition that the person had to have a professional or had to have a degree in, and then there was this long list of things that the degree had to be in, but there was no experience. So, for example, since 30% of Americans are working in the area where their degree is, and my degree is in biology, I don't do a lot of that, but does that mean I would not qualify under those two? Not that I want to be on the PUC, mind you, but I think I could probably sit there and make intelligent decisions. So we started to run into a problem, and the present, having to have one accountant and one attorney and one whatever, has always been problematic. It has caused some of the political fighting over who you put. So we left it open because we couldn't come up with a better definition, and I've said to everybody, bring a better one. And quite honestly, we've bicycled around. Everybody who's come with one, for example, when ARECA came with theirs, I bicycled that. The phone companies don't like that. The one that the phone companies came up with, ARECA didn't like. And so we haven't been able to come up with something.
I'm not adverse to having some sort of qualifications because I, in my own mind, have my own biases toward who we should be appointing to the PUC. I haven't figured out how we should go about embodying all of those biases into the statute. So, quite honestly, it's because we couldn't come up with something that people could agree on.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kelly.
Did you, and what did you think of Senator Adams' proposed amendment?
Senator, I believe the language you're looking at is the language that was provided by Eureka. Is that correct, Senator Adams?
I agree.
I tried the Eureka language out on the telecommunications side, and they didn't like it. So I, you know,
okay.
As I say, I have no problem trying to define qualifications, but where we ran into problems was as we tried to figure out how to define it. Now, let me just say, Mr. Chairman, the House has taken an innovative view and have decided to politicize it in that you have to have a couple of Republicans and a couple of Democrats. I do not subscribe to that theory of how you depoliticize a commission. I thought that's definitely not the way to go. But I haven't had a brilliant idea as to how to do the definition. But Senator Kelly, if you can think of something, we can wing it and see if we can make it work. I'm fully open to suggestions. It's just that none of the suggestions have met the test of trying to get all the parties to be somewhat satisfied.
I won't take up any more of the committee's time on this, but I'm a little concerned about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions of the sponsor? Senator Donnelly.
Senator Pearson, what happens to the existing personnel at APUC? How is their role preserved in this CS, and anything that speaks to that?
There is a section that is transitional, and we can step. We have changed the structure in that there is no longer an executive director per se. So on the effective date of the bill, that position goes away, and you'll look at page 3, lines 16 through 22. The chair of the commission is responsible for the administrative functions, carrying out policies, and the employment policies, and it lays out how those work and the transition. It has been our expectation that the present staff, with exception of the executive director, would transition to the new commission, but that then the commission itself, the new commission, will have the opportunity to restructure the administrative functions as they see fit to make the whole thing more effective and more efficient. There are a number of suggestions that came out of the NERI report for how they could better structure, and that's why we've added things like the opportunity to use hearing officers, but also the negotiating arbitration portion. So we would expect that the staff that exists at the moment would transfer along with all the pending matters, but the new commission has to have the new commission has the authority under this to redefine their staff in the way they see fit in terms of organization. The staff functioning has been part of the problem at the PUC, so that's part of what has changed here, along with just the actual members of the commission. They get to set their structure. Now, we still have hearing officers, and they still have the same sort of staff. At the moment, the staff is hired and fired by the executive director, and that changes under this bill. The commission will hire and fire the staff.
Senator Donnelly.
I have one other question. What's the difference in the bill about the communication carrier section from the existing law. How does that change? No, there's a section of existing law. I think it's 4205.
Section 4204, 100 communication carrier section is exactly the same as existing law. Article 3, the public advocacy section, section 4204, 150 on page 5, lines 21 through 25 in RCS is new law because you're setting up a separate advocacy section inside the commission. They're staff to the commission, but they are set up separately. That comes directly from the NERI report. Let's find the page. Just a moment, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. They talk about legal support of the commission as a critical function but could be improved, that attorneys are assigned to support the APUC needs. Concern is expressed, however, about the level of support provided and the potential for conflict of interest. Given the quasi-judicial nature of most APUC functions, several of those interviewed expressed the sentiment that more legal input into case preparation would be desirable. Because the attorneys assigned do not serve either as strict advisory or advocacy roles, there is a potential conflict of interest created for the attorney. The same attorney who assists with the development of the staff position can also then be assigned to represent the PUC on appeal in a situation in which the commission decided in opposition to the staff position. So their solution was to assign one of the attorneys to the commission staff to advocacy and the other they say this is commonly done in other commissions by the formal split between staff counsel and commission counsel. If a permanent split of the attorneys between advocacy and advisory functions would create uneven workloads, which was a concern between the attorneys, they could be split on a case-by-case
basis. I don't know. I'd like to get rid of it.
The hearing examiners are already separate from both. So the thought of doing what it's our understanding both the FTC and the CERC does, is to set a separate advocacy section within the APUC came out of the NERI report, that you should separate those two functions. And it's on page 16 and 17 of the report that the PUC had done.
But the 4204-100 is just the same as the existing statute, the one that's repealed, the 4202-123?
It's not repealed. No, it wasn't repealed. It's a new section. We are setting up a new section. And so the public advocacy section doesn't exist at the moment.
Right, but I mean the communication carrier section, the one right above it?
It's 4205-123 in the present section.
So the only reason we're doing that as a repealer in the back of the bill is just to change the number so it conforms?
That's correct.
Okay.
The same language is still there.
Okay. That's what I was trying to figure out.
But the advocates being set up separate came directly out of the report, and it is how it's handled. And if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
Fine.
Senator Donnelly, I share with you a concern about timelines, but as I said yesterday, we have often created even more mischief and trouble for all the entities involved when we tried to set timelines in statute. What we could do, we're telling them that they've got to have timeline regulations. They go through an administrative procedure process to adopt those. Those are things I would expect that we would look at next year when we're back with the bill to look at further combinations between the two entities. I would hope that new members of the commission will be interested in trying to begin their work in a timely manner and setting up some sort of a process that we can depend on. On the other hand, because they do enter into joint hearing processes with both
the federal, both FERC and the FCC, it's hard for us to place in statute timelines that are always going to fit the timelines of some of their joint committees that they end up sitting on. And there's always an exception, as you well know, to any rule. This way, if they do it in reg, then if they get in a bind and need to do something different, they can also do always do an emergency reg. Whereas if we put it in statute, they really can't.
Other questions? Senator Kelly, you have a question?